Just try getting a building inspector in Florida.
Pulling them out of their normal duties and putting them on lawnmowers and behind equipment to board up vacant structures and clean up debris.
In Florida and around the nation, people are leaving their homes by the hundreds of thousands. While Washington talks about toxic assets, abandoned, foreclosed homes are proliferating like dead leaves this autumn when subprime takes down whole neighborhoods. You've got your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 23rd. And I think, John, you put this into context for me earlier where you said in Florida, one out of 178 homes facing foreclosure.
That was just in September. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning. We'll talk money and politics. Plus, we'll take an interesting trip into the secret military trials of Guantanamo detainees. Those stories coming up. First, some headlines.
Wall Street is set to open flat in just over an hour, although the futures traders are betting on a dip early on. The futures are down three digits at this point, at least on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Investors will take a look at corporate earnings reports today from Microsoft, Dow Chemical, and Altria. And a dip on Wall Street would be better than the action in global markets. European markets are way down. Asian markets closed lower, some dramatically.
On Capitol Hill yesterday.
The story of the credit rating agencies is a story of a colossal failure.
That's Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman placing some of the blame for economic problems on credit ratings agencies. Top executives from the companies testified in the House yesterday. Companies such as Moody's and Standard & Poor's rate the creditworthiness of companies. Their critics say they did not catch on to the risk of mortgage investments until it was way too late. Credit rating execs won't be the last dragged in for congressional testimony on the crisis. Alan Greenspan, Securities and Exchange Leader Chris Cox, will be on the Hill today. The two of them also on the hot seat, Treasury officials managing the $700 billion bailout.
As you mentioned at the top of the hour, home foreclosures jumped 71% in a year-to-year basis. Foreclosing listing company that tracks them estimates more than a million homes will be in foreclosure by the end of this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 5.7% yesterday to 85.19. The S&P lost 6.1% to settle at 8.96. Again, when markets open this morning, expect flat or negative.
John McCain campaigns in Florida today. Barack Obama stops in Indiana this morning before leaving the campaign to visit his ailing grandmother in Hawaii. In sports, the Philadelphia Phillies have an early lead in the World Series. They beat the Tampa Bay Rays 3-2 on the road last night. Game two is in Florida tonight.
And the election may seem like it's a week and a half away, but in fact, there's all kinds of excitement about early voting all around America. And of course, we're conducting America's exit poll.
We have significantly longer lines now than we did in the 2004 general election. So we're voting approximately 1,500 more a day.
That's an election supervisor from Florida. Are you one of those early voters? We want to hear your stories. If you've already mailed in your ballot, voted early, voting absentee, have you had any problems? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Once again, let's review the economic bidding, shall we? We've got oil prices declining precipitously, and there's an emergency OPEC meeting going on in Vienna right at this moment. We've also got global markets tanking all over, concerned about a global recession and a persistent global recession that begins with slowing growth in China and works its way around the world. About the only thing that's rising today is the value of the dollar. Dow futures are down this morning. London's FTSE was down 86.3 points. The cash that's preferred today is the dollar. If you're getting out of questionable assets, you're probably putting that money into the dollar. At least that's what it's saying. And that has implications for U.S. industries. It also has implications for all kinds of economic phenomena around the world. And to discuss these related and colliding events is our market expert, Hank Potts from Barclays Wealth in London. Hank, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, explain why in the midst of a global recession, the dollar's value would rise, and what are the implications for U.S. businesses from that?
I think fundamentally what we're seeing is that there's a greater expectation of recovery coming through in the United States, and perhaps we're seeing in the Eurozone, or certainly seeing in the domestic market. So it's a mixture between greater dollar strength and also weakness within some of the Eurozone and UK markets. I think we've seen aggressive monetary and fiscal policy coming through from the United States that hasn't been replicated anywhere nearly as quickly in the Eurozone or here in the UK. Therefore, the expectation is while growth will still slow down in the United States, it's perhaps not the disaster that we're going to see here in the UK. Yesterday, we had comments from the governor of the Bank of England and the Prime Minister talking about the fact that we're going into recession, reinforcing market fears over the state of the economy. UK economy certainly in poor shape, failed to grow in the second quarter. Tomorrow, we get the first snapshot of third quarter growth and likely to show contraction. And that's why I think we're seeing the changes. The pound trading down at a five-year low against the dollar today, all the way back to 162. Remember, only a few months ago, what was it, 210, 211?
That's right, that's right. And, you know, Gordon Brown mentions the word recession yesterday, and the pound just, like, goes off the cliff along with the euro. I'm wondering, are there any implications for American businesses who are relying so much on exports for their profits these days?
That's the real problem, of course. While it ironically can actually be quite a good thing in terms of the UK economy, if we start to see sterling struggle, that'll make it far easier, of course, for companies who are trying to compete in the global market space to win back customers and to gain market share at home. And, of course, the opposite is the case if you're the United States who's having to deal with a strengthening US dollar. And we certainly believe that the dollar will continue to strengthen as you look into 2009.
It got a lot of little attention in the United States, but headlines all over Europe were focusing on the Chinese growth slowing. I mean, really, the brakes screeching on in China.
You're still talking at 9% in the third quarter. Anywhere else in the world, you'd take that or even half of that.
Well, sure we would. But I guess if Chinese growth is slowing, does the Eurozone take that on the chin? That is directly, it goes to demand for goods, purchases of goods and purchases of industrial commodities, that sort of thing. If Chinese growth begins to slow down, it affects all of these other businesses?
You make an important point, and particularly we've seen the fact that we've seen a strong reaction coming through in the commodities market. Obviously, what we've seen over the course of the past few years is the fact that China's been sucking in all these commodities, whether it goes from oil to steel and pretty much across the board. Now, signs that the Chinese economy is slowing down, therefore you have an expectation that there'll be reduced demand coming through for these commodities, and that's quickly been reflected in not only the price of commodities but the mining stocks as well, which have come off pretty aggressively in the last couple of months. In saying that, I mean, we know that the risk in China has now moved from inflation back to growth. I think the authorities will be pretty aggressive in terms of cutting interest rates, reducing bank reserve ratios in an effort to try and get lending up there, introduce tax cuts, and there are significant investments when it comes to infrastructure. So the outlook perhaps not as bad as some people have been talking about.
So the engine is still running there in China. The question, though, is this common sense of recession around the world is having a really deep negative effect on markets. Hank Potts, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Hank Potts is a market expert from Barclays Wealth. Adora?
John, here at The Takeaway, America's exit poll is open. Today, two more voters weigh in on their experience in casting ballots in states that are now taking early votes. Will Robinson, good morning.
Morning.
You're in Bradenton, Florida.
I am.
And you voted.
I already voted. I believe, yesterday.
Where did you go to cast the ballot, and tell us how it went?
Well, I went in Bradenton, Florida, which is where I live, and our early voting precinct is at our supervisor elections headquarters in Bradenton. And it went fine. It was actually very easy. There was about 20, 25 people in line. And once you got into the room, there was about 20, 25 people voting. And it probably took, after you got into the room, all of 5 minutes to cast your ballot.
Were you surprised to see so many people?
I was. I was, actually, because I've done it a number of years. Probably 2 or 3 years I've early voted, and this is by far the most people I've seen in line and in the room when they were voting.
And Cole Hickman, you're on the line from Arizona, right? The home of the Republican presidential candidate, John McCain.
Yes, I am.
And you're an Army reservist and an Iraq war veteran, right?
That's correct.
So tell us about where you voted and how that went.
Well, I voted about 2 miles away from my house at the Tempe Public Library, and it went very well. I went last Friday afternoon at about 2:30, and there were only 5 people there. I voted in a regular voting booth, and I was out of there in about 5 minutes.
And, Cole, what motivated you to cast that early ballot?
Well, I always vote early because I can vote at an actual voting booth, but it's also it's a way that I can get it out of the way and have the election day free to do whatever I need to do, usually try and help some other candidates and turn other people out to vote.
And, Will, Florida obviously is a very important state, a critical state. Who'd you vote for and why?
I voted for McCain-Palin, and I just liked McCain's economic philosophy much more than Obama's philosophy.
And I should mention, you're actually the president of the Manatee County Young Republicans. So
that's
you're
right.
Very active. Is one of the reasons why you voted early is because you're going to be busy on Election Day?
Just like Cole, yeah, I'll be pretty busy on Election Day, so I wanted to cast my vote early.
And Cole, you're president of the Young Democrats in Arizona and chair and founder of the Young Democrats of America, America Veterans and Military Affairs. Who'd you vote for?
I voted for Barack Obama.
Because?
Well, like you said, I'm an Iraq war veteran, and I'm very concerned about the war in Iraq and our policies there, and I want to make sure that we have a president who's concerned about how many times people like me have to go overseas. I've only been on my first deployment, but I know people who've been on 2 or 3 or 4 deployments, and so I think it's very important that we have a president who keeps that in mind.
Cole, among those people who have had those multiple deployments, do you find a consensus about where to go in the Commander-in-Chief department?
I do, actually. I have a friend who's a Republican up in New York State, and he's always been very excited about voting for Barack Obama and definitely over McCain because of this issue.
Will Robinson, it's been a very long campaign. What do you think was the most crucial event in getting you to make up your mind and say your friends and the people who you think are going to vote like you?
Well, I think the way the economy has turned negatively over the past couple weeks, people are starting to really focus on what the candidates are saying in terms of what their plans are for the economy. And I think a lot of people that I've talked to, actually on both sides that are voting either way, are supporting their candidate because of that candidate's specific views on the economy.
So the economy draws everyone into their candidate more closely. Is that
mm-hmm.
that's what you've observed? You know, Will, I have to ask, what happened to the Rays last night, buddy?
Gosh, and that's probably why I sound a little groggy this morning, because I was at the game.
You were at the game.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
I was at the game, and Philly just pitched a little bit better and hit in timely situations a little bit better. So they were a little bit better than us last night. We hope to take care of them tonight, though.
What scares you most, Will, the Philly bullpen or the Barack Obama campaign?
Oh, man. Well, the Philly bullpen has yet to be beaten yet. I think there's something like 16-0 when they've taken the lead in the ninth inning. Barack's pretty undefeatable as well so far, so they're both equally tough, I think.
Even though Cole in Arizona, they'll probably go for John McCain. Interesting observation from Will there.
Definitely.
Thank you both for joining us today. Cole Hickman from Tempe, Arizona, president of the Young Democrats of Arizona, and Will Robinson from Bradenton, Florida, president of the Manatee County Young Republicans. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 23rd, and on any day, it might seem talking about rumors is frivolous, but in a presidential election year where there are rumors flying about the candidates that could potentially affect the way people vote, it can be dangerous.
Rumors are a big deal.
Rumors are a big deal. Sometimes they're true. It's really the untrue ones, though, that are dangerous. And what's your favorite untrue rumor we've heard?
Political rumor?
Political.
Oh, that's easy. 1992, the rumor that a new candidate was going to enter the fray. Elvis was actually alive and was going to challenge Bill Clinton. It turned out to be Ross Perot.
Yeah, that was critical. Right. Anyhow, this year, Democratic candidate Barack Obama and Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin have one thing in common, and that is those rumors that they say are fundamentally untrue. For example, he's a Muslim, or her youngest son is really the child of her 17-year-old daughter. And that's just for starters. The internet is just swirling. Returning to psychologist Nick DeFonso, author of The Water Cooler Effect, a psychologist explores the extraordinary power of rumors. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So you're a rumor expert. What exactly is that, and how did you end up doing it?
Well, a rumor expert is simply a psychologist. I happen to be a social psychologist that studies the interaction of people trying to make sense of the world, which essentially is rumor. It's a very old topic in social psychology, and we've learned a lot about rumor psychology.
And you say that rumors clearly are not new in politics, but why do you say that now, in your 20 years of studying rumors, that this year you think that the rumor mill has been more prolific than ever?
I've never seen so many rumors in one political campaign, nor the persistence of these rumors across the internet and the blogosphere. I've never seen such attention paid to them in the press. It's unprecedented, and it's not just me. I've talked to my hoaxbuster site friends, and they're not aware, in their recent past at least, of so many rumors populating the election cycle.
What did you call it? Hoaxbuster?
Hoaxbusters.
Hoaxbusters.
I'm glad they're out there, those hoaxbusters. I'm glad they're the hoaxbuster right. Sites.
So is it a question of the internet, which is essentially a microphone that we've never seen used as commonly as it is today?
Well, that's right. The internet allows rumors to spread far and wide and much more quickly than they ever had before. On the other hand, it also allows people to check the veracity of rumors much more quickly than they have before. But that doesn't seem to be stopping or hindering the flow of these rumors. I think the problem really is the phenomenon of birds of a feather flock together on the World Wide Web. You would think that there would be many types of interconnections and diverse discussions on the internet, but actually that's not the case. People tend to organize around liberal or conservative blogospheres, mm-hmm. and they serve as echo chambers for these rumors to circulate before they're picked up by the national media.
And the discussion typically follows the line, well, you can't prove that it's not true. I mean, it might be true. I mean, and that sustains the conversation. And I'm wondering if the proliferation has anything to do with the fact that the stakes seem to be so high in this election.
Well, people are definitely motivated. The stakes are high. And we're in an extremely polarized political environment. Each year, the right moves to the right and the left moves to the left. And people feel more strongly about the what's at stake in these elections more than ever. And so there's a lot of emotional sentiment. And what I can do as a person, even though I may feel powerless in this election, is to spread a rumor that denigrates the opposite side. And in that way, it vents some emotional sentiment that I might have about the other team.
Nick, I want you to listen to a voter that our political director, Andrea Bernstein, talked to in Missouri.
Yeah, but I don't know who for. If they put none of the above,
on the station, I'd vote for one of them. No way I'm voting for a Muslim. The other guy is too old.
Isn't that the real danger of rumors, in that they get mixed with fact?
Yeah, I mean, where he gets that McCain is too old. I mean, where did that come from?
We should mention very clearly that the rumor that Barack Obama is a Muslim is in fact a false rumor that has dogged him for about 2 years now. It does seem to be hanging on, although the Pew Research Center says that only 13% of the American electorate believes this rumor. Incidentally, the same
13%. That's interesting. Because what's the difference between some piece of information that people cling to, even though there's a million reasons to say it's not true, versus something that kind of passes through and sticks in people's sentences and gets passed off as true almost accidentally?
Well, collectively, there's not much difference, right? So this person evidently hasn't thought about it very much, and yet he accepts it as true. If he were confronted about it, would he cling to it? Possibly. Certainly in his social circle, in his social network, that rumor is probably acceptable, is something he's likely to believe and something he's likely to act upon.
Let me ask you this, though. Sometimes rumors turn out to be true, and isn't that really the heart of the problem? And let's take Senator John Edwards, for example. For months, the gossip papers were dogging him about having an affair with a woman who then had his child, and it turned out to be true.
Well, that's right. Remember, rumor is collective sense-making. It's not all bad. It's the way that people react to a situation in which there's some uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty around Barack Obama. He's new, and Sarah Palin, she's new. This rumor that Barack Obama is a Muslim is false, but there's some uncertainty about his name. It's Hussein. The middle name is Hussein. Why is a Christian man's middle name Hussein? Well, it's an obvious answer to that, and it was a name given to him by his father and his grandfather, who had converted to Islam a generation before.
Mm-hmm.
But he has professed to be a Christian for at least 27 years.
Right, and I should actually qualify the Senator Edwards' comment. The affair at least turned out to be true. As to whether or not it is indeed his child, I guess that's still up for the rumor.
Spreading rumors, that's helpful. Can we hoax bust a Palin rumor before we go quickly?
Yes, Trig Palin is definitely Sarah Palin's son. And of the many, many rumors associated with Senator Palin, most of them, or possibly all of them, have been shown to be false. These hoaxbuster sites do a great job. Snopes.com, truthorfiction.com, and urbanlegends.com. These people spend their days investigating rumors, coming up with a verdict, and listing the evidence by which they make their verdict available, so that you can judge whether or not you trust their conclusion.
Nick DeFonso, psychologist and rumor expert at the Rochester Institute of Technology. So what do you think? Rumors are good or bad?
Rumors are tantalizing and delicious. I love them all. I do. I love them all.
They can be fun until they get to the point where they actually start destroying people, and that's bad.
That is true.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 23rd. Femi Okeh has just joined us, and you got a little bit of breaking news, some jobless numbers, right?
I do. Just coming up to 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. The new jobless benefit claims increased to 478,000. That's up 15,000 in the week ending October the 18th. Wall Street looks headed for a lower open today based on futures trading. And this comes a day after declines for European and Asian markets. Real estate troubles are at the very center of the current economic problems. New numbers show that foreclosures are up. The foreclosure listing service, RealtyTrack, says they jumped more than 70% in a year. Nine people are dead after a suspected U.S. missile strike hit a Taliban-linked school in the northwestern part of Pakistan earlier today. Intelligence officials say the school is in the middle of a region inhabited by militants, and no students are believed to have been in the school at the time of the attack. And just doing some quick baseball news for you, the Philadelphia Phillies took the lead in Game 1 of the World Series last night. They won 3-2 over the Tampa Bay Rays. The series continues tonight in Florida.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we've done a lot of stories on Guantanamo Bay and the military tribunals down there. And, you know, if you think of a transcript, it's a document that is the official record of something that took place in a courtroom or maybe a public hearing. But if those words are read, the event begins to come alive as more of a drama. And if actors read those words, then you have perhaps the basis for a film or a literal drama about what's gone on behind closed doors. And that's exactly the premise of the movie The Response, which uses transcripts in part to create a film that recreates the experience of being in the courtroom of military tribunals at Guantanamo. And producing and acting in the movie, The Response, is Sig Leibowitz, who joins us from Baltimore, Maryland. Sig, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, it's not the first time that transcripts, sort of public documents, have been used to elucidate events that are very remote and maybe difficult to recreate and impossible to document. How do the transcripts create a sense of reality about these tribunals in your film?
Well, I think what's really amazing, for me, I had a sense of, or I thought I had a sense of what was going on in Guantanamo. I think most people tangentially have an idea of what it is, you know, and you feel like, oh, I read the papers, I watch the news, I listen to the radio, I know what's going on, but then I read the transcripts, and they just really opened my eyes and really took my breath away. And I think what they do, what we've heard from audiences, is for the first time it really lets an audience see and hear what actually is behind these stories, what actually is happening on Guantanamo. And I think it really opens the window to these tribunals.
Well, what you see are people facing an incomprehensible sense of their accusations, the crimes against them. And you're also seeing lawyers in court, military lawyers in court, openly questioning and sometimes confused about what the process is. Let me play one of the scenes from The Response that involves the defendant here, and you can tell me a little bit about what's going on here. Listen.
For 4 years, I have told the interrogators I don't have any knowledge of this. Who is this person who is saying that I am involved in this? Tell me his name, and then maybe I can tell you if I know him. But I don't know if he's a terrorist. Maybe I know him as a friend.
That, of course, is an actor familiar to watchers of The Daily Show, who is playing the defendant in the film. What's going on in that scene, in his speech there?
Yeah, that is Asif Manvi, known from The Daily Show for his comedy, but he's an amazing actor. What's going on and what the transcripts show, in these tribunals, these specifically are the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, or CSRTs, what that shows is, you know, I think we all have a sense of what we think, you know, the American justice system is, or even what, you know, what court martials are. But what's happening in these CSRTs is that there's no defense attorney. There's the detainees are not allowed to see the evidence against them, and they're not allowed to confront who is bringing the charges. So in this case, the detainees, they don't know who has claimed that they are a member of a terrorist organization. I think what's also important that the film gets out is there were bounties paid by the American military to the Northern Alliance or other groups, no questions asked. If they turned over, you know, if members, supposed alleged members of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda were turned over, and bounties of like $10,000 or $25,000 were paid, no questions asked. And you can imagine, you know, how much that money, you know, means here in America, and
sure,
of course even more so in Afghanistan.
Well, I guess does the frustration that the actor is conveying in that scene come through in the transcript, or is that something you're adding?
No, I think it very much comes through in the transcripts. And obviously, I was looking at tons of transcripts, and I mean, there are amazing sections that obviously there wasn't enough time to put those in either.
Well, let's listen to some of the interactions of the lawyers here in this selection.
In this case, the captured informant knew the detainee's name, his address in Afghanistan, his engineering background. Couple that with a declaration from our own intelligence services.
All of which the detainee had no chance to respond to, because as an alleged enemy combatant, he's not allowed to see or confront the classified evidence against him.
It's the same rule that all detainees must face.
Excuse me, Colonel. So we have this informant who's maybe being tortured, and he might be naming names to stop that. And we're supposed to evaluate this tortured informant.
Allegedly tortured informant.
Wow. I mean, that's directly from the transcript, and I'm hearing a lot of skepticism, and all of these people are military officers.
That's correct. Well, I think that portion you use, that's from the deliberation sequence of the film. So some of that, as opposed to the first part, which is taken directly from the transcript, some of the other thing is taken from various panels or different things that take place among different military scholars, former JAGs, you know, about what's going on there. And yeah, I mean, there is a lot of frustration. I mean, I think what's important to remember is it's the military JAG officers themselves who first brought up the questions and their concerns about the process. So it's not coming from, you know, it didn't start with any liberal groups or different groups from outside the process. It was actually the military JAGs, these people who are really on the front lines, if you will, of defending the Constitution, who first came up with the concerns about what was going on.
Sig, I thought your production was brilliant because it truly does bring to life. We feel like we have a sense about what's happening in some of these proceedings, but until you actually hear it in context, it really felt to me like it did boil down to one of the sentences at the end where the lawyers are speaking and they say, well, maybe he knows something, maybe he doesn't. And that's really what the process boils down to, right?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. That's really it. And I think what I found from the transcripts and what the director, Adam Rogers, and myself really wanted to get across in the film was the fact that these military JAGs, they're caught in the web of what's going on, just like the detainees are.
He wrote in it, he acted in it, he produced it. Sig Leibowitz, thank you very much. His film is The Response, and you can see it at www.theresponsemovie.com. Thanks, Sig.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And if $147 a barrel oil was an emergency for consumers around the world, $68 a barrel oil is an emergency for the ministers of OPEC, who are gathered at an emergency meeting in Vienna today. And in the lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel in Vienna is Carola Hoyas, who's the chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times. Carola, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Nice to be there.
The test really for OPEC is, can they defend their price by lowering production? And really, whether they do or not, they're in a bit of a bind here. What's OPEC likely to do, do you think?
Oh, well, that's the kind of million-dollar question at the moment. They're terribly split with some countries that really need high oil prices to keep their economies running, saying they want an immediate and very deep cut, and others, and in fact more powerful members, who, such as Saudi Arabia, hinting, in fact, that this wouldn't be such a good idea when the economies of the consuming countries are in trouble. You don't want to increase oil prices. You want to get them back on their feet so that they can, demand oil. There's also a political overhang here because, of course, you've got the elections in the U.S., and the Saudis really don't want to anger the incoming president just 2 weeks before he's elected. So that's everything that they have to think about here, and it's really tricky. I don't know what they're going to do. They tend to like to surprise the market because it will give them a bigger upshot if they do. So often it is very hard to believe what you're being told.
Is it a different economic situation to sell a lot of oil at a low price versus less oil at a higher price?
You're right. I mean, this is the calculation that these countries have to make. They have to say, well, this is how much we can produce, and that'll have an impact on the price, of course. And there is a perfect threshold for all of them. But, for example, Iran and Iraq and Venezuela need the oil price threshold to be very high, at around $90 to $100 a barrel, whereas somebody like Qatar, which is a tiny little country, needs it closer to $10 a barrel. And Saudi Arabia, who is the big gorilla here and the most important voice, needs it at about $50 a barrel.
Interesting.
So they all have different targets.
So the oil's rise was unprecedented and rapid, but its decline is by a couple orders of magnitude even faster and even more unprecedented. I'm wondering if you're seeing any signs with oil at its lowest level in 16 months of ministers, you know, maybe cutting back on expenses, smaller entourages, maybe they're carpooling, the Qataris are with the Saudis in the same limo, that kind of thing?
No carpooling, and then also no plane pooling either, which would be an even bigger expense saver. So far, I haven't seen it. The Saudis haven't come into Vienna yet. I will be counting Rolex watches for you, though.
Thank you. Give us a sense of the scene right there in the lobby of the intercom where the meeting's taking place.
There's a really big buzz. I don't know if you can hear that behind me. There's basically the expectations of the Saudis to arrive in the Grand Hotel in Vienna, just steps away from the Intercontinental. Lots of other people are staying here where I'm standing. There are, at least kind of 20 reporters in the lobby pretending to just be sitting there sipping Viennese coffee, but in fact they have a hawk's eye on the front door.
Well, we don't care about the reporters. We don't care about the reporters except for you, Carola.
Of course, but there's a Ferrari outside, so I guess things aren't too bad.
Carola, you're killing me. You're killing me. She's chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times. She joined us from Vienna, where OPEC is having an emergency meeting to deal with the declining oil price. Emergency for them, maybe.
Not if they're pulling up in Ferraris.
Doing all right.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 23rd, and we have some headlines for you from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. More third-quarter earning reports are coming in this morning. The news from big companies is mixed. Hotel chain Starwood and JetBlue are both down, while Xerox is up a little bit. New jobless benefit claims are up 15,000 to 478,000. The jump is being linked to our weak economy. Consumers are buying smaller cars, not gas-guzzling SUVs, and that's one of the reasons Chrysler is planning to speed up the closure of a Delaware factory. About 1,000 people work there. And scientists say that for the first time they found a drug which may in some cases repair brain damage caused by multiple sclerosis. Researchers from the University of Cambridge believe they found an effective treatment for the commonest form of the neurological disease. Dr. Alistair Coles is part of that research team.
What we've reported today is that an experimental drug called alemtuzumab can deliberately damage the immune system and allow it to rebuild itself. So we are tackling the cause of multiple sclerosis and allowing the immune system to rebuild itself and be better behaved to stop attacking the brain.
And the drug, alemtuzumab, was originally designed to treat leukemia. And scientists believe it's the first drug with the potential to not only stop multiple sclerosis, but even reverse the effects of it. It's still going through clinical trials. It's early days now, but looking very, very promising.
So many therapies involve regulating the immune system. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's all
that's it. Oh, that's it?
Yeah, I'm done.
We wanted more, Femi.
In fact,
we wanted
I'm 2 seconds over, so I'm probably in trouble.
Uh-oh.
Over to you guys.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Here at The Takeaway, America's exit poll is open, and we've gotten many calls with people's experiences on how they voted. We've also gotten calls like this one, concerned about some of the early voting practices. Listen.
My name is Chris Vezatinsky. What I really want to talk about is voting for the military. My daughter is forward-based. She's on a warship in Japan and has asked for an absentee ballot from the state of Massachusetts. This has not worked before, and I'm not sure it's going to work this time. So she hadn't received it as of 2 days ago. She hadn't received her absentee ballot to vote in Massachusetts.
For decades, men and women serving in the U.S. military overseas have had trouble casting their votes. It's a 60-year-old system of paper mail-in ballots that's clearly outdated in the computer age, not to mention that unworkable today with tens of thousands of U.S. forces fighting wars on two fronts based all over the world. We're joined now by Bob Carey, a senior fellow at the National Defense Committee, to talk about some of the obstacles that you believe, Bob, many people in the military are facing in being able to cast their ballot. Why don't you give us a list of some of them?
Well, first, thank you very much for having us on today. It's an honor and appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. This is, as you said, this is a 60-year-old problem. In 1952, President Truman sent a letter to Congress talking about the disenfranchisement of military personnel because of the reliance upon paper ballots and postal mail delivery. It just won't work. The whole absentee ballot system was based upon the idea of sending a ballot across town, not across the world. And so the deadlines for the delivery of absentee ballots and for the return of absentee ballots simply won't support the physics of getting a ballot around the world and back. So in 2006, I'm sorry, go
that
ahead.
That is in 1952?
Oh, yeah. This problem has been known for decades, and no changes, no substantive changes have really taken place to the system. For the most part, we still rely upon paper ballots being sent out too late. Your caller yesterday was talking about her daughter, who is a Massachusetts voter. Massachusetts doesn't even send out its absentee ballots until 21 days prior to the election. Now, mail takes about 12 to 18 days to reach a combat zone by the standard. So if everything goes perfectly, mail's not going to get over there until about 12 to 18 days later. And then it takes another 12 to 18 days to get back. Well, so even the minimum will mean that for Massachusetts, the ballot will not be able to get there and back in time.
And that's
Rhode
just,
Island is also...
That's,
I'm
and,
sorry,
and just to know, that's just one state. And as you explain, one of the major problems is that the rules are different in every single state. How is that? The military is a federal department. The right to vote is a federal right. Why isn't this handled by the military?
The Constitution gives to each and every state the right to choose the method of electing its of conducting its own elections, both state and federal elections. Congress does have the right to preempt that federally, but they're loath to do that because the states, you know, hold a lot of sway on this issue. And so the only law that's out there right now is called the Uniform and Overseas Citizen Absentee Voting Act of 1986, but it's very limited in its scope of what it will preempt federal law. So basically every state will determine when, you know, they will send out their absentee ballots, when you have to have it back by. So one state will say you have to have your absentee ballot back by the day before the election. Another one will say, well, if your ballot is postmarked by the day of the election, we don't have to get it back until 8 or 10 or 14 days after the election. And what happens is that the voting assistance officers that are in each of these units are trying to help these people through this process. But because there's so much complexity and so much variety amongst the states, the voting assistance guide that the Department of Defense puts together for them is 466 pages long.
Oh, gosh.
Bob,
now, if you're a first-time voter and you're trying to wade through 466 pages of regulations, chances are you're going to say, this is just too difficult.
Well, Bob, what I'm hearing from you is that our listener, Chris, is out of luck, period. Correct?
Not fully. We have a strategic part of the National Defense Committee called the Overseas Vote Foundation. And what they've done is www.overseasvotefoundation.org. What they've done is they've taken the provisional ballot that military personnel and overseas citizen voters are allowed to use, called the Federal Write-In Absentee Ballot. And they've put it online, and they've populated it with all the federal candidates by your address. So you go online to overseasvotefoundation.org, you put in your address, and it'll automatically bring up a version of this federal write-in absentee ballot for you, and you choose your candidates, and then you print it out and you send it in. Some states also will actually email the blank ballot to, and this is a recent occurrence where some states are now allowing the actual emailing of a blank ballot to military personnel, which will take, you know, the delivery of the ballot off the equation. You still have to send the ballot back in. Not many states, only about seven or eight states will allow for a voted ballot to be emailed or faxed back in. But at least that will, you know, allow you to receive the ballot immediately rather than having to wait for the absentee ballot to arrive by postal mail. So if they go to, so if a military voter has not received their absentee ballot yet, today is their election day. They need to go online to overseasvotefoundation.org and download this federal write-in absentee ballot and send it in today.
Well, what about those, Bob, who say, look, soldiers are young and they're irresponsible, and the reason why there's only a 26% return rate is because, well, they just don't feel like voting.
Well, you know, the figures don't, you know, back up with that. In the general population, about 40% of the general population voted in 2006, and only 22% of the military voted in 2006, which, you know, you see people say, well, they're young and they're first-time voters, they don't want to vote. But when you look at the absentee vote ballots that are requested, 660,000 military absentee ballots were requested. If a person's going to go to the effort to request an absentee ballot, you can pretty much, and in the general population, 85% of the absentee ballots that were requested were returned. But for the military, only 26% were returned. That's 484,000 military ballots that were requested and not returned.
Wow.
That's more than a third of the military requested an absentee ballot and didn't get the chance to cast it.
So there is some relief, though. I hope Chris is listening and that
great
her daughter, exactly, if it's just that simple, just very quickly, is this something that's been well advertised so that members of the military are aware that they can do this?
Unfortunately not. The Federal Voting Assistance Program, which is the organization within Department of Defense that runs this, says that there is no problem. And in fact, that the military, they believe the military votes at a higher rate than the general population, and that it's all because of their voting assistance program, which we believe to be a bit Pollyannish. And so they have actually not allowed the Overseas Vote Foundation to be able to advertise on Armed Forces Radio or the Armed Forces, you know, or Armed Forces TV.
So the fight continues, Bob, essentially. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Bob Carey, Senior Fellow at the National Defense Committee.
Great
stuff. Here's another early voter story.
Hi, this is Ruth. I'm calling because I heard about absentee ballots. My daughter lives in California, and she found out for my granddaughter's absentee ballot there was extra postage needed. And the postmaster told her hundreds of absentee ballots have been returned. Would you think the government would stamp on the envelope extra postage required? I'm very concerned about this. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
It's great stuff. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join America's Exit Poll. Here's your takeaway.
There's a Ferrari outside, so I guess things aren't too bad.
Your takeaway about the OPEC meeting in Vienna. That's Carol Ahoyas, Chief Energy Correspondent for the Financial Times. We're always on here at The Takeaway. If you missed anything at all, go to our website. It's free at thetakeaway.org. Podcast to go each morning on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
In this economic crisis, at least we don't have to worry about asteroids hitting the Earth, right?
Taking too long.
We got jammed up at 75 feet.
We're losing one.
Time! Get the hell out of there!
It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity, and you can't pull me down. Okay, I can't sing, but fortunately there are scientists who have a way to save us from asteroids. Wicked. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 23rd, and it's a memorable day, and we have lots of really important news to
thank you for your
impart.
Support. Thank you so much. We actually are going to talk about the threat of asteroids, right?
Yes, we are. We're going to talk about the far-fetched threat of asteroids, but it is real, and there are a distinguished group of people holding a conference today, and they're actually talking about it. And we're also going to talk about the threats to our economy and to your bank accounts. But first, a few headlines.
Wall Street is set to open lower in a few minutes. Futures traders are betting on a dip. New jobless numbers are out, and it's just not going to help. More Americans filed unemployment claims than expected, nearly 500,000. Investors will also react to corporate earnings reports today from companies including Microsoft, Dow Chemical, and Altria. Global markets suffered today. European markets are down. Asian markets closed lower, some dramatically. Oil rebounded a bit after a $5 drop overnight. It's been hovering above $67 a barrel, and watch for that. Move as OPEC meets to debate a possible production cuts. Members of OPEC would like to see the price go up a bit more.
Yesterday on Capitol Hill, it was the credit rating agencies who were strongly criticized.
The story of the credit rating agencies is a story of a colossal failure.
That's Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman lashing out at executives from those agencies in the House. Groups like Moody's and Standard & Poor's sometimes gave good ratings to mortgage investments that went bust. Credit rating execs won't be the last that will be dragged in to testify on Capitol Hill. Alan Greenspan will be on the Hill today, as will Treasury officials, working on the $700 billion bailout.
Many of those Treasury officials are former Goldman Sachs employees. They may be getting resumes from some of their former colleagues soon. Reports out this morning say Goldman will cut 10% of its workforce. On the campaign trail, John McCain is in Florida. Barack Obama stops in Indiana, and then he leaves the campaign trail, as we reported, to visit his ailing grandmother in Hawaii. The World Series began last night. The Phillies begin their game one, a 3-2 victory over the Tampa Bay Rays. And in America's exit poll, we've got stories from you.
I voted on an absentee ballot early, and actually I found it a little bit confusing because every party gets to choose which slate they'd like to put forward. So actually John McCain and Sarah Palin were on the absentee ballot several times, having been nominated by lots of different parties.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, how about you? Have you already mailed in your ballot? Did you go in person? Were there long lines? What's your story? How did it go? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Stories of early voting on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the markets. As usual, OPEC gathers in Vienna for an emergency meeting on the declining oil price. Oil is bouncing around at about a 16-month low at this hour. The markets are holding a rally, at least in the futures pits, and it appears that on Wall Street there may be a flat to negative opening this morning. Markets everywhere else around the world were declining. The only thing that's spiking these days is the U.S. dollar. And what does that mean? Antonio Regalado is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Mexico City. Antonio, thanks for being with us.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
You know, your story yesterday in the Journal was really amazing to me, and it really talked about how behind the scenes companies all over the world, but particularly in Latin America, have made some pretty big bets, and in at least one case, bad bets, on where the dollar is going to go. Can you describe, first of all, the story of the retailer in Mexico who Monday was huge, and on Tuesday was bankrupt?
This is a big retailer that goes by the nickname of La Comer here in Mexico City, competitor of Walmart, and one of the largest retailers in Mexico. And they have quite a strong business, but their CFO came back from vacation early this month and discovered that the company had basically gone bankrupt due to bets against the U.S. dollar.
Now that sounds like a reckless decision on the part of company officials, but on some level, we should be reminded that companies around the world, particularly in emerging markets, have to be concerned about currency prices and make bets like this to deal with their operating expenses, because they're constantly sort of translating from one currency to another to support their exports and imports.
That's exactly right, and that activity is called hedging. You buy or you sell dollars in the future because the value of your exports, say soybeans, or the cost of your imports, in the case of this company, products, TVs, and such that they're buying and selling in Mexico. You have to balance one against the other. But what has become clear is in Latin America is that people stop using those hedges as insurance, and they started simply betting against the dollar. And when the dollar took off earlier in this month, they ran into a lot of trouble.
So now the bet they were making, and it's not irrelevant to the whole sort of macro picture of global markets, the bet they were making was not an unreasonable one. It was that the economy is turning downward, the U.S. is heavily leveraged, so therefore the dollar is probably going to get weaker. What they didn't count on is that the rest of the world would get so weak that the dollar starts to look good.
Exactly. I mean, in Mexico, there was a widespread view that the Mexican peso, which had been appreciating against the dollar, was going to continue to appreciate. And in Brazil, the local currency there, the real, had reached all-time highs against the dollar. And so people just did not foresee that the dollar would suddenly take off. I mean, in the case of Brazil, the dollar went up about 40% against the real in just a matter of 2 days, as investors started to flee Mexico and Brazil, and they needed their dollars, actually, because they were having to cash out positions to pay their investors, et cetera.
Well, I want to talk about that in a minute, what the sort of realities of that are in just a moment. But first, I read somewhere that Mexico has gone in a 12-month period from being the second biggest growth economy in Latin America after Brazil to being an economy that is essentially on the ropes. What is the impact of that kind of a reversal on the streets of, say, Mexico City?
Well, I've been here for about 2 weeks, and the typical question I'm getting from taxi drivers is this crisis going to affect us? So I think right now it's really still a lot of concern about what the future might hold, but there's little doubt that Mexico is going to be affected because Mexico is a huge exporter of the United States. I think that the just the consumer numbers are down in the U.S. and Mexico, among countries in Latin America, is the most exposed to this crisis and the effects that it could have in the United States. Less so other countries like Brazil and Chile, but certainly, the effects are being felt. This case of these companies going bankrupt because they bet the wrong way on the currency is probably the most dramatic one that we have so far.
How about this? Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan just this morning in the last few minutes said that the current financial crisis is a once-in-a-century credit tsunami. Do you think, is Mexico a victim of this unprecedented economic situation that the world is facing, or is there some other problems in the Mexican economy that helped bring companies to where they are today?
Well, I think over the last few years, really economies in Latin America have done pretty well. I mean, there's been an export boom. They have gotten their sort of economic houses in order, following sort of orthodox economic policies. They've built up big dollar reserves. So in a sense, Latin America, Mexico, these countries are in the best position they've ever been in. And when the crisis starts to get going, you would hear the heads of the central banks, the heads of the countries, Brazil's President Lula saying, we are well protected against this crisis. This is not our crisis. This is the crisis of up there in the United States. And their tune has quickly changed as the problems have spread here in unexpected ways.
Well, that, you know, that's what's so painful about what's going on here. I mean, we're seeing pictures from Argentina of lines outside of banks of people trying to convert their local currency into dollars or their questionable investments into dollars. With the world leaders in Latin America, with leaders in Latin America suggesting that perhaps the success of the last few years meant they were out of the woods, the traditional woods of hyperinflation and instability, it's raised the expectation. I'm wondering if this persists in Latin America, if we're going to see a wave of political instability as well.
Well, that's a good question, because Latin America is divided between countries that I mean, if you think of Venezuela or Bolivia, I mean, countries with populist leaders, which have a kind of, you know, socialist program of taking over companies by the state and that sort of thing. We saw an example of that in Argentina just yesterday when the president of Argentina said that she was going to nationalize the pension funds, which is basically a huge grab on private property. That is clearly not a popular move, but it's not clear to me that the crisis will drive Latin America in one way or another. I think that the economies that have adopted sort of orthodox economic policies and in a sense are more to the right are going to do better, and that the crisis could bring serious problems to countries like Argentina and Venezuela that have questionable economic policies, you'd have to say, and I think the crisis may bring social unrest and trouble to those countries.
Well, and Venezuela has to worry about the oil price, which is going down to an unprecedented degree. Let's talk then for the short term in the last few seconds that we have. Antonio, you mentioned that one company there at the top that made a bad bet and all of a sudden is bankrupt. Are we going to see the veil come off some of these other companies in Latin America who are going to reveal that maybe their books are in much worse shape than we thought?
Definitely. I mean, we don't know the extent of this problem yet. In Brazil, they've been asking all the countries, all the companies to disclose their losses this quarter. And so there's definitely probably more to come. We don't know how serious the problem is.
Antonio Regalado is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Mexico City. It's fascinating if you look at the world map, how the tsunami, as Alan Greenspan calls it, is going to be hitting each individual country. And the out-of-the-woods expectations of Latin America are certainly more sober now, but as Antonio says, it's going to affect every country differently.
And such an important element is that there is a lot of talk that when they start investigating exactly what went wrong, there's a real question about transparency. And some of these companies that are by day selling clothes, but by night were investing heavily in currency transactions, came as a big surprise to those who were holding shares, thinking that I'm putting my money into a company that sells jeans. But no, they're making money by, you know, gambling, some would say, well, in the currency market.
And it's not simply Latin America. I mean, General Electric, a lot of people don't realize, is mostly a financial company. That in most quarters, its profit comes from being a financial player, being more like a bank than a jet engine producer. In any case, we want your stories and our discussion about the global economy is available online at our website, mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Also, we're America's exit poll. Are you voting early? Have you voted early? What's your story of the infrastructure of America's democracy for the early voters standing in line all around America? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Thursday, October 23rd. While Western and Asian banking systems have faced increasing turmoil, in Africa, the banking systems have managed to remain mostly untouched by the subprime mortgage crisis, a model of restraint, say some. Joining us to explain is Martin Plaut from the BBC. Good morning, Martin.
Oh, good morning.
Now, here's something that just can't be said about many, many developed countries today, and that is the IMF report, there is no systematic risk to any African country in terms of banking. Can you explain?
Well, it's not that difficult to understand, really. I suppose, in a sense, it's the result of Africa being so marginalized for such a long time. I mean, if one takes it at the extreme, let's say that you were a subsistence farmer in the highlands in Ethiopia. You know, you're wandering around with your goats and maybe a few cattle, a donkey or so. Well, you know, who cares what happens to, the subprime market? It makes absolutely no difference to you whatsoever. Now, of course, that is at the extreme, but there are a lot of people who still live in Africa. About half of the entire continent lives in rural areas where they really have a marginal connection to the world economy.
But in terms of the banking industries that do exist, they're heavily regulated in a way that has prevented them from jumping into the fray in the last couple of years of all of the market ups.
Sure. And I mean, if you take two examples, either Nigeria or South Africa, Nigeria had an absolutely appalling banking system until quite recently when they did a big transformation. They regulated the system. They reduced the number of banks. And they also made it absolutely clear that they had to have the right kind of capital reserves in order to undertake their lending. In South Africa, it's more or less a hangover from the apartheid time when there have been strong controls on the amount of money that you're allowed to take out of South Africa. And that has meant that there are plenty of money sitting in the South African banks to lend and to borrow when they need to. So it really is, in a sense, Africa has been fairly isolated from what is going on. I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that there's no implication for
Africa. Oh, certainly not.
But,
certainly not.
The banks certainly are looking quite good shape.
South Africa, you just mentioned, interestingly enough, is actually more integrated into the international financial system than other countries. And they've certainly felt the pinch of just the financial aspect of it. And then obviously we could talk about how this affects commodities throughout the continent.
Absolutely. Well, South Africa, because it is more integrated into the world, does feel the effects more directly, and in a sense, in two particular ways. The South African economy has been running a major balance of payments deficit for a long time. The way this has been responded to is that South Africa has allowed people to invest in the country. There's been a lot of buying of South African shares. That inflow of money is now disappearing in the opposite direction because, of course, international investors are desperate to get their hands on any money they have. So the rand, the South African currency, has fallen dramatically in the last few days because of this. On the other hand, South Africa also needs to borrow in the international markets, particularly for its power sector. I don't know if you remember, but there were terrible electricity cuts in South Africa earlier this year. The mines had to close, that sort of thing. So the Electricity Supply Commission, Eskom, needs to borrow $34 billion in the next 5 years. Now, that is a lot of money for any country, and particularly in Africa. When they tried to launch the first tranche of that, which was $500 million a couple of weeks ago, they couldn't find any takers at a price that was acceptable. They had to withdraw it. Now, that's a big blow.
And, yeah, not encouraging at all. And then you add to that commodities and the decrease in world demand. Let's start with oil.
Well, sure. That is going to be a big blow. And the Nigerians have just said that they're going to look at their budget again for next year. But the price of oil has come down from, what, $140 to something like $70. It's halved in the last period. But the last budget was predicated on an assumption that Nigeria drew up of $62.5. So they were pretty conservative. They must have clocked up plenty of reserves in that period. The question, of course, in Nigeria and has to ask is what happened to the reserves, where did they go? And that's people have been thrown out of the country for asking those kind of questions. But just let me give you a couple of examples. The Ugandan Central Bank today has come out saying, yes, there will be a reduction in growth from about 8% to about 5 or 6%. Well, I bet you the United States would love to have a growth of 5
right,
or 6%.
Right. No question. And very quickly, last question. It's not just oil. You also have commodities from copper to produce.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. So somewhere like Zambia will be affected by this. They are a big, a copper producer. Somewhere like the Democratic Republic of Congo as well. They will be hit. I'm not trying to suggest that Africa is unaffected by it, but we're talking probably a growth rate of around 5 or 6% next year, which is not really bad at all.
Not bad at all. Martin Plaut, thank you so much as always.
Pleasure.
Martin Plaut is the BBC Africa editor who joined us from London. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got a few headlines, I suspect.
Thanks so much, Adore. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Futures point to a flat opening on Wall Street in just a few minutes. Investors are taking in an increase in unemployment claims and mixed third quarter reports that keep coming in. Oil prices are recovering after a big drop last night. And prices are still way down from a high in July. The OPEC cartel is expected to cut production when they meet tomorrow, which should send prices up more. Pirate attacks off the coast of Somalia have surged more than 75% since last year, and that's according to a report from a maritime organisation. Waters off the coast of the country are the most dangerous in the world, accounting for a third of the world's pirate attacks. The United Nations announced today that North Korea is dealing with a food shortage crisis in which millions may face starvation. South Korea has not yet decided whether to respond to a request for food aid. Relations between North Korea and South Korea have been tense in the last few months. And the world's largest research library is the British Library in London. Let me give you an idea of how big it is. It holds more than 150 million items in many, many, many languages. Some go back as far as 300 BC.
Are you bragging?
It is the British Library.
is that 300 BC?
Yes,
incredible.
It is. Stay awake. You will like this, John. The library has some new archive material and is putting some rare recordings out on CD. Here's the writer, F. Scott Fitzgerald.
By your gracious patience, I will a round, unvarnished tale deliver of my whole course of love. What drugs, what charms, what conjurations, and what mighty magic for such proceedings I am charged withal.
He's stumbling around in a bar.
I would never have guessed that's what he sounded like. I have never heard him speak before.
And you know why you've never heard him speak?
Why?
There's only 8 hours of tape of recordings of him. So this is really, really rare.
And the Brits ripped it off?
Of course. They're really good at pillaging. The CD also includes Tolkien, Virginia Woolf, and Conan Doyle. So it's actually
great.
Worth a listen. Some really rare pieces of audio.
Wonderful.
There.
Yeah. Just wonderful. Hey, my mom's a librarian. What can I say? I love books.
Excellent stuff.
There you go.
Okay, that's a look at your news for now. I'll see you in 10 minutes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In the early moments of trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is attempting to defy gravity. It's up about 35 points in the face of bad market news around the world. But gravity is a serious issue if you're trying to get up in the morning. I mean, if you're having trouble literally getting out of bed, gravity is not your friend in that situation. But get in the shower, turn on the water, water falls down right on your head. Gravity is your friend in that situation. Go into the kitchen, pour yourself some coffee. Gravity, again, your friend. Coffee lands right in the cup. I mean, assuming you're aimed correctly. But if an asteroid is traveling through space and comes into Earth's gravitational field, that's really bad. Gravity is not our friend in that situation. And scientists are so concerned about the possibility of an asteroid hitting us at some point in the next 150 million years. There's an asteroid deflection research symposium in Arlington, Virginia, to come up with a global plan of action in case an asteroid should be drawn into Earth's gravitational field. Well, to talk about this, we brought our friend joining us to discuss what scientists have as a scenario for dealing with gravity and asteroids. Carter Emhart is the director of astrovisualization at the Rose Center at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also the director of the film Cosmic Collisions, which includes a scenario of how we might use gravity as our friend to deflect an asteroid away from us. So, Carter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
First of all, gravity could be our friend in the case of an asteroid hitting the Earth?
Well, actually...
How would that work?
Actually, yes. One idea that astronaut Ed Lu, who was on the space station for about 6 months, came up with and that we actually depict in Cosmic Collisions is the notion of actually using gravity assist from parking a spacecraft next to a small enough asteroid. This would actually have to be a small enough asteroid for this to work, but we actually have one that is a potential threat, although the probability of that has been lessened by a greater constraint on its orbit that we now know based on some radar observations from Arecibo, the largest radio telescope in the world.
So how do you use the gravity of a space station to deflect an asteroid?
Well, if you know one is coming on a collision course and you have enough time, you could park a spacecraft next to, not actually even touching the asteroid, and you would actually deflect its exhaust, so it's not actually shooting at the asteroid itself. But gravity works as it's a mutual attraction force. And so that if the asteroid's small enough, the spacecraft is massive enough, they're both exerting a force on one another. So it's essentially a gravity tug. And with a spacecraft...
And a slow gravity tug.
Very, very slow. So again, the force is perhaps minuscule, but if you operate that force over a long enough period of time, then you may take what was a collision course with Earth and move it just off the Earth. So we know that perhaps it's going to just miss the atmosphere. Then we have a good day. So
why not just blow it up, though, like they did in Armageddon with Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck? Why not just do that?
Well, then you're actually it's like a shotgun. You basically you put a bunch of debris out there, and that's coming in all over the place. So you create a mess in that case.
On Earth or just in the
galaxy?
No.
Actually, you break the asteroid up into pieces, and those individual pieces are then coming down all over the place. And so that is a potential threat. But the asteroid Apophis is...
That's the name of the asteroid.
That's the name of the asteroid. It's going to actually pass... if you're in Europe on April 13th, 2029, you'll be able to see this thing pass between the Earth and Moon. Quite bright, and it will miss the Earth, but it comes by every 7 years.
But in astronomical terms, that's a near miss. That's a scary distance.
That is a scary distance.
Scary distance. Do you have any faith that the Asteroid Deflection Research Symposium in Arlington, Virginia, is going to come up with some realistic scenarios?
Well, actually, yes. I mean, there's some very good ideas, and in discussing this with Ed Lu, when he came to the American Museum of Natural History to talk about this, was that if you have a potential threat, what you need to do is really sort of fly a spacecraft out and put a transponder on it so that you can then use radio back and forth so you can actually really understand the characteristics of its orbit and make sure whether it's going to hit the Earth or not. And then you have enough time, hopefully, with these threats. So a big deal about this is actually being able to detect the threats and being able to have something such as the Space Guard Survey, which is active and actually looking for potential threats.
Early
interesting
detection.
Is it's a serious list of people who are attending this conference: NASA, the U.S. Air Force, the Air Force Research Laboratory, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, et cetera, et cetera. So taking it very seriously, and how to figure out how to read that asteroid.
Well, if you take a world armed with nuclear weapons, such as we are, and people on high-level threats threat warning and so forth, and if you have such an event as Tunguska, which happened exactly 100 years ago over central Siberia, this is an airburst that went off at about 40,000 feet, they believe it may have been a comet there.
Wow.
And it destroyed about 800 square miles of, or actually flattened, the forest out there. But this burst was, they believe, somewhere between probably 10 to 15 megatons.
That's huge.
This is a huge burst. Yeah. And so
these things can happen. They're yes. not out of the realm of possibility.
There was about a megaton blast over the Mediterranean in 2002.
Incredible. Watching it all for us, Carter Emhart is the director of astrovisualization at the Rose Center at the American Museum of Natural History. You can go to the Rose Center and see Cosmic Collisions, his movie, which actually shows how an asteroid would be coaxed out of its trajectory towards Earth. It's not a Bruce Willis kind of thing. It's more a Deepak Chopra kind of
love that. You're
kind of like, let's
perfect.
Move away from the Earth. Kind of. And now headlines from Femi, okay.
21 minutes to the top of the hour. Thought I just saw a mirage. The Dow was up 50 points or so. The Wall Street is now open for business. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifies before Congress today, along with Securities and Exchange Commissioner Chair Chris Cox and other Treasury officials dealing with the $700 billion bailout. He calls the economic crisis a once-in-a-century credit tsunami. A drug that's been used to treat leukemia may actually repair brain damage in patients with multiple sclerosis. Researchers at the University of Cambridge found that patients treated ended up in better physical shape after taking the drug. MS patient and professional golfer Tony Johnston tried the drug, and it definitely had an effect.
So I'm back in the gym, I'm playing, I'm competing, I'm out on the seniors tour, and I had my first win this year. So, you know, to be told that you're never going to play again and then to get out there and to be able to compete doing the thing you love the most, just, I'm a very, very lucky chap.
Now, before taking part in the trial, Tony could only walk 4 or 5 yards, and that's the whole point of the drug. Alemtuzumab is what it's called. It's still being studied. Clinical trials are still going on, but it looks like it has a lot of potential. In baseball, the Philadelphia Phillies took the lead in Game 1 of the World Series last night, and they won 3-2 over the Tampa Bay Rays, and the series continues tonight in Florida.
It's a best of what series? Best of?
Best of?
Seven.
Seven.
Seven. World Series.
There's a way to go yet.
Yeah,
are we there yet?
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adore Udoji. Today, our partner, the BBC World Service, is gauging consumers to test exactly how the credit freeze is affecting them. And they're doing it by looking at the car industry. They're talking to correspondents all over the world, from South America to Africa and to Asia. And here's the thing. Paying cash to buy a new car just isn't an option for most people. They and you need financing. And the trouble is that now, because of the credit crisis, loans are harder to come by. To talk about the perfect storm, as some have described it, that's hitting car manufacturing and sales, we're joined by BBC business correspondent Ian Brimacombe. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
So what's happening out there?
Well, it's quite a mixed picture, but it's quite an incredible one. I guess we've been focusing so much on with this financial crisis on the financial world and on housing, but people often forget that the car industry absolutely depends on credit. And the fact that those loans are drying up means that manufacturers, suppliers, dealerships, communities around the world are really being hit. So we wanted to gauge kind of what the picture was around the world. And as you've said, we went to the four corners of the globe and we looked at different stories in different places. And we've been gathering that material and programming it across the day.
So what have you found? Give us an example in one corner or another.
Yeah, I mean, we had a really interesting cross-section of examples. I mean, what was kind of nice about this project is it gave us an opportunity to go to some places that we might not necessarily go to in the context of the car industry. Like, we went to Africa, for example. Now, Africa's car production is really just a drop in the bucket when you compare it to the rest of the world. You know, Africa, I think, made something like 700,000 cars last year. Now, compare that to Asia, which made 29 million. But we went to Southern Africa, which has seen a lot of growth in recent years. And South Africa is actually where a couple of big European manufacturers have their car plants. And we went to a factory just north of Pretoria, mm-hmm. where a leather seat manufacturer was talking to one of our correspondents and saying how the knock-on down the chain is really hurting production at this factory. And he was talking about potentially having to lay people off, certainly cut back on shifts. So that was one kind of interesting illustration of how, you know, the fact that cars aren't selling in Europe is affecting somebody manufacturing leather seats in South Africa. We also went to Japan. I mean, that's the most obvious place to visit, perhaps, because Japan makes more cars than anywhere else in the world. They made about 10 million last year, and they export to more places. And Japanese car makers are telling us...
I suspect they're in big trouble.
They're in big trouble, and they're very, very worried about the coming year. I mean, Toyota is saying that for the first time in a decade, it might have negative sales. We spoke to the head of a Nissan plant, or a boss at a Nissan plant, who was talking about how this is the biggest downward spiral in sales figures that he's ever seen in his career. And a big reason for that is because these Japanese car makers export a lot of cars to the United States. And the fact is that because the credits dried up in the U.S., a lot of these Japanese car makers just aren't able to sell cars.
Or there's just too many cars in the world, period. Too many.
That absolutely might be the case. I mean, it's extraordinary when we think about the growth in some places, particularly, you know, China. We've been talking the past couple of years about this incredible growth in China, 25% growth a year. Now, it looks as though that's coming down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people in the industry are hoping that will continue, obviously, because they
certainly
want to sell cars.
Certainly hoping that perhaps China will step in and save the day. Ian Brimacombe, thanks so much.
Okay, pleasure.
Ian is a BBC business correspondent coming to us from London.
Too many cars. Interesting.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 23rd. Femi Okeye has just joined us, and boy, we certainly have a lot of economic news already this morning.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning to you, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Dow is down around about 40 points. Asia and Europe markets closed down today. Oil prices, meanwhile, are recovering after a big drop overnight, and prices are still way down, though, from a high in July. The OPEC cartel is expected to cut production when they meet tomorrow, which should send prices up more. Pirate attacks off the coast of Somalia have surged more than 75% since last year, and that's according to a report from a maritime organisation. Waters off the coast of the country are the most dangerous in the world, and they account for a third of the world's pirate attacks. And the UN announced today that North Korea is dealing with a food shortage crisis in which millions may face starvation. South Korea has not yet decided whether to respond to a request for food aid, and relations between the two countries have been tense in the last few months. Congress has strongly criticized credit rating agencies for breaking the trust put in them. A House of Representatives committee suggested that there was a conflict of interest as the agencies are paid by the clients they are rating. Republican Congressman Christopher Shea says no one can put their faith in what the credit rating agencies actually say.
You have no credibility that you have so screwed up the ratings as to not be believable anymore.
Credit rating execs won't be the last dragged in for congressional testimony on the crisis. Alan Greenspan, Securities and Exchange Leader Chris Cox will also be on the Hill today. And that's a look at the news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
We've
also been taking a look around the country as people are beginning to vote in 31 states. There is early voting possible officially in 31 states, and absentee voters are able to vote early because that's how you do absentee voting. But anyway, as America's exit poll takes a look at actual voters, we're discovering that there are problems and challenges for people on the front lines of democracy all over the United States. Joining us now is Jennifer Edwards, who's the Supervisor of Elections for Collier County, Florida. Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Also, Annette Cappy is the town clerk in Brattleboro, Vermont. Annette, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Debbie Quivy, is it?
Yes, that's correct.
Debbie Quivy is director of Athens County Board of Elections in Athens, Ohio. Debbie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, you know, I think of you three as heroes because democracy depends on things working in your necks of the woods collectively. Jennifer, what are you most worried about as you, first of all, look at the lines for early voters and then think about what's going to be the lines for people on Election Day?
Well, that's why we encourage our voters to vote early. And in our county, we've been voting early since 2002. And our county voters have really embraced early voting, and we have significantly longer lines now than we did in the 2004 general election. So we're voting approximately 1,500 more a day than we did in 2004.
Wow, 1,500 a day?
So what's the total per day then?
That will help us. On election day, we're voting on a daily basis about 3,600 voters.
3,600 per day, and that's just in Collier County, Florida.
Annette,
in Brattleboro, Vermont, have people embraced early voting? They're a little more traditional up there in New England.
Well, we're pretty traditional, but yes, they are embracing early voting. We've been doing early voting for several years also, and each year we see the numbers grow. I think people really enjoy being able to get out early, not fight the crowds, and this is Vermont. We don't have the numbers that some of the other larger states have, and we're townwide rather than countywide. So I think people, once they've made up their mind, and there seem to be many, many decisive voters already this year, once they've decided, they come in and do their public duty, and then they're home free.
Well, Debbie, that's interesting. Annette says once people make up their mind, they say, what the heck, let's go down and vote. Is that what you're finding in Athens, Ohio?
Yes, that's what we're finding here. In Ohio, this is the first time that early voting, or it's what we call no-fault absentee voting, has been offered in a presidential election. So everyone's starting to realize that they can come and do what's called this absentee voting. And we're a smaller county, but we have doubled our numbers. In 2004, in the general, we had around 3,000 voters, but we have now doubled that. We're approaching 6,000. And we're voting about 100 a day in our office, which is a lot for us,
right?
Because we've had 2,500 people go through our office since September 30th.
Now, is there any sense of the people in your neck of the woods, Debbie, there in Athens, Ohio, that they're early voting because of problems that Ohio has had with its infrastructure on Election Day, that they want to make sure their vote is counted, and so they're voting early for that reason?
I can't speak for the whole state. I can just speak for Athens. I don't get that feel here in Athens. Things have ran pretty smooth for us, and we expect that to happen again. I think people are just excited about the election. They're realizing they can vote early. They want to vote early, avoid those long lines, and I think it's just the excitement of doing it.
Jennifer, do you find that also in Florida that there is this general sense of excitement about this presidential election, and that's why people are flocking in?
Absolutely. And that was emphasized, too, because over the last few weeks we've had Sarah Palin here, and we had Bill Richardson here this week in our county, and we've had Joe Biden here. So that really energizes our voters, and they want to come out and vote and be able to cast their vote and wear their I voted stickers.
Do you find, Jennifer, that as soon as one of those candidates comes or one of those surrogates comes, a high-profile person like Governor Richardson, do you find that immediately, like right after the event or the next day, you get sort of a flush of voters, that people are just making up their minds after having this personal interaction or personal observance of these candidates?
No, it's immediate, because what they do is they hold a rally and they hold it near an early voting site. We have 7 sites across our county, and so they hold their rally near the voting site, and then they lead perhaps a few hundred voters to the nearest early voting site. And that's what's happened.
Literally lead them to the polls.
Pied Piper, is that a vision that you're describing?
Well, that did happen in one of our communities the first of this week when Bill Richardson was here. He was at a park near the public library where we were holding early voting, and he indeed did lead about a few hundred people.
Well, that's interesting, because there are a lot of regulations on Election Day that you can't campaign near polling sites, so this early voting has really mixed up a lot of the regulations. All right, the three of you...
Well, let me add that we do have the 100-foot rule in Florida,
really?
And that is... enforced.
So Richardson has to stay outside. All right, folks.
Correct.
This is the end of the easy questions, okay? It's hard from here on out, all right? We have a few minutes to go.
Be careful.
Jennifer, or I'll start with you, Annette. What's
yes.
the breakdown, Republican or Democrat, in the early voting? Can you tell me? Are you allowed to?
I don't know.
You don't?
I mean, we have no idea what people are casting for votes. Vermont has been traditionally Democratic in the past several years, but I can't say. Voters coming in seem very enthusiastic. Younger voters are more more apt to be discussing who they're voting for.
Well, I'd be getting a lot of younger voters, and I got to move to Debbie. Getting a lot of younger voters?
Oh, yes, we definitely are. We are a college town. We have Ohio University here in our town of Athens, so we're seeing a lot of college students, and we can tell by talking with them and looking at them. You know, they're young, and they're excited about wanting to vote. A lot of them are first-time voters that are very excited.
All right, Jennifer, so, I'm going to give you the last word here. Statistics reported by the New York Times yesterday suggest an even split between Republicans and Democrats doing early voting in Florida. Is that what you're seeing? You certainly know who's registered. You may not know who they're voting for, but any indication of the split party-wise?
In our county, 50% of our voters are Republican, 26% are Democrat. So that is what we're seeing coming out to the poll.
Well, they're splitting Republican and Democrat 50-20. Who they're voting for, unknown. But Jennifer, Annette, and Debbie, thanks so much for being on the front lines and telling us how all the early voting is going. And Jennifer Edwards is the supervisor of elections down in Collier County, Florida. Annette Cappy is the town clerk up there in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Debbie Quivy is the director of the Athens County Board of Elections in Athens, Ohio. Great stuff. I love it.
Oh, great stuff. You know what? We didn't ask Jennifer if she's any relation to Senator Edwards.
Edwards. Yeah, that's a really unusual name.
Just dawned on me. We're always on here at The Takeaway, and we're conducting an American exit poll of voters. Have you voted early? If you did, how was it? Were there long lines? Did you fill out a ballot at home? Did it work for you? Did you run into some snags or to some problems? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
Let's say that you were a subsistence farmer in the highlands in Ethiopia. Well, you know, who cares what happens to, the subprime market? It makes absolutely no difference to you whatsoever.
That's Martin Plaut, BBC Africa editor, talking about how the financial crisis may not be so bad for African economies.
Yes, you can escape the economic crisis by going to the highlands of Ethiopia, if you like. Right now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 55 points after being up in the early going. You can join our conversation online always, because we're always on at The Takeaway. If you missed anything, you can catch up with us on iTunes.
You want to make me one promise, John?
Was
on the air?
Oh, no, don't go back to that. Don't go back to the pain part, okay?
No.
No more show tunes. No more show tunes. We can make that as a promise here.
How did you know that was what I was going to say? How did you know that?
Body language. Toxic asset.
I'm adoring you, don't you? This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.